Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
Let's pivot now to some, to just unpacking some of the fundamentals about how free speech law works, because I think there's a lot of things that quickly become familiar when you go to law school and become a lawyer and study the matter that are not necessarily obvious to non-lawyers. So the Constitution says, with ellipses here, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, no law. And read literally, that seems so extreme as to be unreasonable. I mean, I can't burst into a courtroom during someone else's trial and just start shouting, no more taxes. The judge is entitled to have me taken out of that courtroom. If I work for the CIA, I can't just announce state secrets. But why?
Right.
No law abridging freedom of speech. Or if someone has a copyrighted text, I can't just reproduce it and sell it. All of those, in some sense, are abridgments of speech. And so how does the law handle these sorts of situations? And who decides? Who decides where the limits lie?
Right. Well, so again, one thing that people sometimes say is it doesn't say no law abridging speech. It's no law abridging the freedom of speech. So one possible answer is to look at the freedom of speech of how the as the framers understood it. Just like people say, you know, when we talk about in the double jeopardy clause, you can't be placed in jeopardy, twice in jeopardy of life or limb. Like, what does that mean? Is it just applicable to things punishable by death penalty or dismemberment? Well, no, let's see how the framers understood that. So one possibility is to say, well, you know, there are these exceptions that are historically recognized. But again, turns out the historical record is pretty thin on that. There are certain things that we can say definitely were recognized, like limits on libel. But other things, you know, we don't really know for certain. So I think what had happened, rightly or wrongly, but over the last roughly 100 years, the Supreme Court has essentially said this is a principle, it's an important principle, and we're going to apply it with an eye towards traditions, but basically our job is to construct a legal doctrine that implements this principle.
Ah, so if I may. So what's going on in the law, for good or ill, as you say, is that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, is taken seriously but not literally, as we say these days, and the exceptions or limitations are defined by the Supreme Court in its case law.
Right. That is the way that we have implemented this.
So the who decides question is being answered. The answer to that question is the Supreme Court decides.
The Supreme Court decides.
Ask another question. I'm a father. I have two daughters. Let's say I tell daughter one, you know, don't say shut up to your sister. And she says, Dad, I have a right to free speech. Is she right?
So what you need to tell her is, young lady, you're obviously unacquainted with the state action doctrine.
Ah, tell us about the state action doctrine.
So the one thing we do know is the first word of the First Amendment is Congress, right?
Yes.
Now, that's actually been read to include other parts of the federal government, federal courts, the executive branch. And then the 14th Amendment says no state shall, and it's been read as basically, it's a complicated story, but it's basically applying much of the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, to states, which includes local governments, which are just agencies of the state.
So on that note, I think it's now fair to say that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech is taken to mean, again, by the Supreme Court, no piece of the government apparatus, no part of the state in the sense of the government, shall abridge the freedom of speech.
Right, except I would just say that it's that Congress shall make no law coupled with the 14th Amendment, no state shall. Because otherwise it's very hard to say why is California or the University of California Congress.
Right.
It's not, but it is a state.
Ah, so the University of California, your university, for example, University of California at Los Angeles, is a piece of the government. It's
exactly.
A state actor, and it's
exactly.
A state actor insofar as it's a state university as opposed
exactly.
to a private one or something
exactly.
else. Okay.
So that's not parents. It's not private shopping mall owners. It's not private social media platforms. It's not private employers. It's not private universities. It's not even universities, private universities that get government money, which is pretty much all universities. But it's not that. It's only the government and its subdivisions.
So what we have in the law is a binary distinction between, binary might get a little nuanced, but we have a more or less a black and white distinction between government actors, broadly defined. They include mm-hmm. things like administrative agencies or universities,
right.
as well as the president and Congress and the police and such. And we have non-government actors. And the right to free speech applies only to government actors. This is the state action doctrine.
The constitutional right to free speech.
The constitutional right to free speech.
Now, it turns out that there are some statutes that apply free speech rights more broadly, and sometimes some state constitutional provisions and such. Just by way of analogy, the Equal Protection Clause bans race discrimination, let's say, by the government. Well, what about private employers? They can't discriminate based on race. Right, because there's a federal statute, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So likewise—
Could you just, for our listeners, just define statute and distinguish it from the Constitution?
Sure. The Constitution does several things. It protects our rights through the Bill of Rights against the government, but it also creates a federal government. And state constitutions structure the state government. What's one important job of the federal government? Well, it's to enact new laws. Enact a statute is just a law that's not enacted as part of the Constitution. It's just enacted by Congress. It could be repealed at some point, but most of the laws we're governed by aren't the Constitution. They are statutes.
So you've got two overlapping layers of law. You have the constitutional, we have our Constitution, including our constitutional rights, chiefly apply to governments. And then you have a second layer of law, a statutory law, which is created by Congress or our state legislatures and may extend some of our constitutional rights to other actors.
Right, right. Most statutes, or I'd say most statutes, certainly very many statutes, bind private people. There are statutes that make it illegal to murder someone, right? There used to be common law rules that were created originally by judges, but now they're all embedded in statutes. So the Due Process Clause that says the government can't just murder people. Well, what about private individuals? Well, they can't murder people either because there are statutes that make it a crime to murder people. The government can't take my property without just compensation. That's in the Fifth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, that's part of the Bill of Rights. And private people can't steal my property. That's in the statutes, although again, originally was created as a common law rule by judges.
So imagine I work for a company. I mm-hmm. work for, United Airlines or Delta or this pencil company or what have you. And they say, don't talk politics mm-hmm. on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Is that legal? Can they do that?
Well, that depends.
So the state action, they're not a state actor, let's
right.
assume. So the First Amendment does not apply to them. They're not restricted by the First
right.
Amendment. So what is there any statute that restricts them?
Well, it depends.
Depends. Tell
Chiefly,
us.
Chiefly, it depends on what state or maybe even what city you're working in.
Huh.
So, for example, my own state of California has a statute that bars employers basically from firing people based on their political activity. The Supreme Court of California has read political activity not just limited to voting or running for office or contributing to a political campaign, but it has said it deals with the advocacy of any candidate or cause. And the statute doesn't say off the job. So in principle, if they fire me for my on-the-job political activity, that could be a violation of the state law. Although an interesting question is, what if they say, well, we're firing you because you're talking politics to the exclusion of doing your work? Well, maybe that's okay. What if they say, we're firing you for talking politics and people are offended by your political views? Interesting question, oddly unresolved. But that's California law. Speaking of Delta, I believe there was a lawsuit in Colorado. I believe it was against Delta. Somebody had written a letter to the editor working for Delta, sort of criticizing Delta. And the court said, at least in part, that's protected under Colorado law, which actually isn't limited to political activity. It deals with all lawful but only off-duty activities. So I think it was enacted chiefly to prevent employers from firing employees for smoking or drinking or something off the job. But speech is just as lawful, at least as lawful as smoking and drinking. So in the Delta case, the court said, yeah, at least as to certain kinds of speech, you know, this is protected by the statute, but because it was off duty. And then there are other statutes that are different. So, for example, Washington state statute is limited basically to campaign-related political activity. So it varies from state to state. And sometimes there are cities and counties that have particular rules. So, for example, Seattle in Washington actually protects a very broad range of political speech, more so than Washington state law does.
Okay, so this is complicated, but essentially there is a First Amendment which is being adumbrated by the United States Supreme Court and restricts the activity of state actors, pieces of the government. And then there is a tapestry of state statutes and even city ordinances which regulate the behavior of private institutions. So the answer to my daughter is, when I say, don't tell your sister to shut up, is, and she says, Dad, I have free speech, is, young lady, I'm not a state actor, I'm not subject to the Constitution. But she might then say, well, what about our state statutes or our city statutes?
Right. So since you're not her employer and you're not a place of public accommodation, let's say, you would probably not be constrained by those statutes. So the statutes just don't purport to even apply to you. And then on top of that,
Might be free of all restrictions with respect to her speech.
Right. And on top of that, you may have parental rights. The Supreme Court has recognized as a constitutional matter that parents have an unenumerated right to control in considerable measure the upbringing of their children. So maybe even if a state wanted to say you can't restrict the speech of your child around your dinner table, maybe that would be unconstitutional. But there hasn't been any case law on that because no state has actually tried to do that.
Let me pivot to a less facetious example. I see now, I think it's clear to our listeners now, that the state action requirement is a really, really big deal. But I wonder how absolute it is. So let's say, I work for company X, Apple, United, Google, fill in the blank. It's a private company. And they order me to publicly support President Biden, or the opposite, publicly oppose President Biden. So they're greatly imposing on the content of my speech privately. They're only subject to state law, relevant city ordinances, I guess. And let's just imagine that we're in a state that doesn't have relevant statutes. Can they really do that? Can they really forbid me at pain of being fired from supporting President Biden or the opposite, or even compel me at the pain of keeping my job to express support for President Biden or the opposite?
So it certainly doesn't violate the First Amendment
if
they fire you for that. I would want to talk to an election lawyer to see if a corporate order that employees express support for the president, or for some, maybe not even the president, let's say for some candidate for office, might violate some restriction on corporate contributions to the candidate's campaign. Because you might say that that's basically an in-kind contribution. It's an interesting question. I don't know. I will say, obviously, employers have to have the right to order at least certain kinds of employees to express certain kinds of political messages. Because let's say a company decides we want to express a message of support for gay rights, or we want to express a message of a position to drug use or something like that. How can the company do that except by having a spokesperson express that? So the company, at the very least, the spokespeople, presumably the company has to be able to say, it's your job to tell you these things. Likewise.
Well, maybe not one person, but it really is, that's a very far cry from a company firing you for opposing gay rights or opposing abortion or something.
Well, but again, if they're just firing you for opposing gay rights or opposing abortion, that's not prohibited by federal statute. By hypothesis, we're in a state where it's not prohibited by state statute, so we're not in California. And this issue sometimes comes up. Imagine there's a company that has a uniform where it says, oh, and you have to wear an American flag because we want to convey a message of patriotism. And somebody says, I don't want to do that. Well, it's your uniform. You got to wear your uniform. Now, there is actually a federal statute that that basically requires companies to accommodate religious objections to generally applicable job duties. So maybe if a Jehovah's Witness says, I have a religious objection to displaying an American flag on my body, or there is a case that was recently litigated in Arkansas, and I think just recently settled, which involved an objection to at least what the objectors perceived as a gay pride flag. Or gay pride symbol on the uniform. The company said not at all. It just happens to have rainbowish colors, but that's just because that symbolizes something completely different. There again, there may be a religious exemption under that federal statute. But again, it takes a statute. You can't just say, well, this company's firing me unfairly. That's not illegal.
So it turns out.
Unless it is, unless there's some statute that makes it illegal.
A lot of ordinary American citizens have intuitions about how sweeping their free speech rights are that are actually not constitutionally accurate. They have very substantial free speech rights vis-a-vis the government.
Right.
But much more nuanced and individuated free speech rights, if any,
right,
vis-a-vis private actors. But what about, last question on this theme, what about when private actors and governmental action are, as it were, sort of marbled together or entangled. And
right.
I'm thinking here particularly about universities.
Yeah.
I work for Northwestern University. It's a private university, but it's private in a very distinctive sort of sense. It has 501c3 status, so it counts as
right.
a charitable entity only because the government says it counts
right.
as one. Takes federally funded loans.
Right.
It's eligible to get federally funded loans. Perhaps most obviously, it takes grants, and a massive
right,
portion
right.
of its budget is taxpayer-funded through
right.
grants. Does it count, just for purposes of law here, not normatively should it count, but does it count as a purely private actor, or is there some legal relevance to the entangling of its of public and private and its functioning?
For purposes of constitutional legal rules, it is a private actor. It is not a government actor. And I can say that with confidence because there's a case. I think it's from 1982. It's called Rendell Baker versus Cohn. It involved, if I recall correctly, a school for children, I want to say with developmental disabilities, maybe behavioral problems. But the important thing is it got tremendous levels of state funding.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was like 90% of its funds came from the state. And then an employee sued saying it was essentially a state actor when they fired her. And the court said, no, it is not a state actor.
So this is interesting.
But yeah.
Oh, pardon me, please.
But the important question isn't who does the funding. The important question is who makes the decisions. So if the government told that school, you have to fire people who express certain views, then that would be state action. And she could sue saying I was fired because of this impermissible governmental action. And that's true even if it wasn't a condition for funding, right? On the other hand, if the government isn't making the decision, if the private school is making a decision, it doesn't matter also who's funding it. So the test isn't who's funding it. The test is who makes the decision and if the speech restrictive decision. And if it's a private entity, then in that case, it's not government action as for First Amendment purposes. If it is the government, then the First Amendment does apply.
I think that that case illustrates a second truth about this, which is that these what you just said about this school that received 90% of its funding from the state counting as a private actor for First Amendment purposes. It isn't, as it were, a fact of nature, an inevitable truth
right.
in our legal system. It is a decision made by the Supreme Court.
Right.
And if it were to be undone, it could presumably be undone by another decision by a different Supreme
right.
Court. Okay. Now, pivoting to another question, some speech, not some other forms of expression, are illegal. Child pornography, for
right.
example, is light speed illegal. Racial slurs will get you fired. Generally offensive speech seems to have consequences in our society.
Right, but that's not the same as illegal. Lots of things will get you fired.
What if it got you fired from a state actor?
Ah.
So I want to talk about in this question is what are the limits? of free speech protection? And in particular, what about hate speech or what about offensive speech? Do we have First Amendment protections insofar as we work for state actors?
Well, all right. So the first question, if you're thinking about free speech issues, is it the government that's acting?
We'll settle that it's the government.
The second question is, what is the capacity is the government acting in? So one answer is, you might say, loosely, government is sovereign. It's threatening to lock you up. Why can it lock you up? Because it's the government. On the other hand, if the government is acting as, say, proprietor, owner of, say, a building, and it says you can't have a demonstration inside the hallways of the building, well, it's just acting as owner of the building. It's pretty comparable to what a private building owner might do. Likewise, if the government is acting as employer, it's saying, look, we're not threatening, again, to throw you in jail for something. It's just, if you want to keep getting the government paycheck, you've got to do things our way and say things our way. This, by the way, doesn't mean that all bets are off. It doesn't mean the government has completely unlimited latitude in those areas. It just means that the rules are different. Likewise, if the government is acting as K through 12 educator in primary school and high school and the like. And there are a bunch of other such categories. So let's take an example of employment. So there's a case from 1971, Cohen v. California. Cohen was walking through a courthouse with a jacket that says, fuck the draft. And he was prosecuted, not, by the way, for a specialized rule that says no vulgarities in courthouses, but under a general law, makes it a crime, essentially as interpreted by California courts, to basically publicly display vulgarities. Supreme Court said, no, you have a right to speak, and that includes the right to speak in a vulgar way.
Hmm.
Well, but imagine he works for the post office, and imagine he goes around, he pins a fuck the draft badge to his uniform. Or let's say you come up to him and say, can I buy some stamps? He said, absolutely, but I should just tell you, fuck the draft. Right, the employer would be free to restrict that. Now, by the way, it might be free to restrict that just by saying, look, we don't want you to attach any pins to your uniform. It's a uniform, after all. Or we don't want you to express any views to customers other than maybe have a nice day or something like that. So maybe it wouldn't even focus on the vulgarity, but it could also say, for example, for certain kinds of jobs, if you show up to work at the school, we don't, as a teacher, we don't really care what you wear, what kind of tie you wear. So you want to wear a tie with one design, that's fine, another design, fine. But if it has fuck the draft written on it, no. It's entitled to do that. And the reasons are complicated. I mean, the doctrinal rules are complicated. It's that the government can restrict speech by employees if it's just a matter of private concern. And it might conclude that vulgarities, even on ideological topics, might count as not public concern speech, but private concern speech. There's some sense that kind of it can regulate the form of speech by government employers, even if not the viewpoint. And sometimes it can, even for public concern speech, you can be fired for speech that is seen as too disruptive of the workplace or too disruptive of the relations with clients and the like. Mm-hmm. Now, what if the government is acting as proprietor? It probably could say in a courthouse, no vulgarities on any clothing you wear, because it has the special rule. A courthouse is called a non-public forum. Mm-hmm. It's specialized government property. It's not like streets or parks or sidewalks, which are usually subject to the same rules as for the government of sovereign. It's an inside of a government building. It's different. But the government may not be able to restrict your ability to express certain viewpoints, even if they do cause a lot of offense. Government employers, maybe it does have this ability. So the rules end up being quite complicated and different depending on the government's role.
Notwithstanding that complexity, could we linger on the word you just used, viewpoint?
Yes.
Imagine that the a state actor, like some government administering a courthouse building, says you can't have disruptive speech during trials.
Right.
In the courthouse.
Yes.
And imagine it's litigated, it goes to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court approves that. And the same courthouse follows up with a second rule. And this one says, you are allowed to say, I oppose abortion.
Right.
But you are not allowed to say, I support abortion.
Right.
So in this point, the government here is taking sides.
Right.
Where you're allowed to express one side, just not the other. What is the legal status of that sort of
right.
viewpoint preference?
Right. So that, what imposed by the government as proprietor, would be viewed as unconstitutionally viewpoint-based. So here's an analogy based on a recent case, Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky. Polling places are generally viewed as a form of government property. It turns out some of them are private property, but they're taken over by the government for the day of the election. And they're viewed as essentially a form of non-public forum, government property. And that means that, for example, the government can say no electioneering. You can't go to vote with a MAGA hat on. Well, actually, let's not even say MAGA hat, a Trump hat or a Biden hat on. And if you do, then we'll tell you you can't go in until you take it off. And if you're wearing a T-shirt, then say, look, go home, change your shirt, or go to the bathroom, turn it inside out. On the other hand, what if it says, oh, you know, you can't express any pro-gun rights views, but you can express anti-gun rights views, or you can't express racist views, but you can express views that support racial equality. That would be unconstitutional because it's unconstitutionally viewpoint-based. And by the way, the particular case involved not something that was facially viewpoint-based. It was involved a prohibition on political symbols and the like. But there was no definition of political. It wasn't that mention a candidate or a ballot measure. It looked like it was totally up to the local election judges, the people who are there in the, maybe election judges is the wrong word, the election workers, people right there in at the polling place to decide, well, this is too political, this is not. And there was an exchange saying, well, at oral argument, well, what if somebody comes in wearing the text of the First Amendment on their shirt? Oh, that's not political. How about the Second Amendment? Oh, that is political. And so I think
I think at that point you've lost your case.
Right. So I think the court's view is, look, that vague definition, if there is a definition at all there of political, is so potentially subject to viewpoint-based administration that we're just not going to allow it.
Follow-up to that. One of the lessons of this exchange has been that the character of our free speech protections is considerably more complex than we might imagine. We start from some simple words, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And we have a sort of general American creed, a cultural commitment to free speech that makes, you know, even my 12-year-old daughter likely to say, Dad, you can't do that. I have free speech. It's just sort of been internalized in our culture in a very broad and nonspecific way. But as I've talked to you, it's been remarkable, the level of complexity and nuance that arises. And that leads me to two questions. Two final questions, I guess I should say. The first is about this viewpoint preferencing. You repeatedly said that viewpoint preferences are unconstitutional. Can we say that notwithstanding all of this complexity, they are clearly unconstitutional?
No. I hope I said viewpoint preferences are unconstitutional when the government is acting as proprietor, even in a non-public forum, even like, say, a polling place. Here's an example where viewpoint preferences are perfectly constitutional. Let's say the government hires me to teach high school. Probably would be a big mistake, but let's say it does. And it hires me to teach high school geology, and it tells me, when people ask you how old the Earth is, it's several billion years. I forget the number of billion people assume. It's not 6,000 years, let's say. Or even, we want you to teach in high school civics that America is fundamentally a good country and you should be proud to be an American. And if you teach the opposite, you know, that's not the viewpoint we want taught. There, the government is essentially acting as speaker. The government is entitled to convey its own views. Generally speaking, there are some exceptions about religion, but basically it's entitled to convey its own views in a wide range of topics. And that has to, because the government can only speak through people, it has to mean that when it hires people to speak on its behalf, it is entitled to require them to say what they want. to return to an earlier example, imagine that it hires a poster designer to have an Uncle Sam Wants You recruiting poster. And instead the poster designer says, fuck the draft, right?
Right.
No, actually, you know, recruiting is generally, historically, not the draft, but imagine it was a pro-draft poster. They could say, we're not going to pay you the money that provided in our contract, because the contract says we want you to create a pro-draft recruiting, or let's say pro-draft poster rather than an anti-draft poster. Right? So when the government is acting as speaker, it has to be able to discriminate based on viewpoint. And there are some other situations where the court has said it's allowed to. Like the government as employer does end up having considerable authority to impose even viewpoint-based restrictions on speech that the employer or the employee says not for the government, but that is seen as too disruptive because of its viewpoint. And that's a controversial position, but descriptively, I have to tell you that's the rule that the courts apply.
So one last question in this segment of our time together, unpacking general aspects of free speech doctrine. It is really quite striking how complex and elusive First Amendment doctrine really is. So different from what many of our intuitions is. And my question is this, after observing all this complexity, can you somehow bring us back to center? Is there something simple that we can, after appreciating the range of complexity, we can nonetheless apprehend something pretty clear about what our First Amendment free speech rights really are?
So I think Immanuel Kant, supposedly, you're the philosopher, you can confirm this for me, famously said that out of the crooked timber of humanity, nothing straight has ever been built.
He did.
So out of the complicated world we live in, for a complicated phenomenon such as communication, because we use communication for all sorts of things, to communicate all sorts of different ideas and non-idea-based forms of expression, you're not going to have a simple, straightforward rule. And it probably doesn't make sense to have the same rule for when the government is acting as sovereign, as the government acting as speaker, as the government acting as K-12 educator. So I don't have a very simple rule to give you. I can say that generally speaking, the government can't punish you for expressing particular viewpoints. Generally speaking, that's a very important basic principle. Generally speaking, it can't even deprive you of important benefits for that. But there are zones in which the government has a job to do, and where, especially when it's trying to communicate certain viewpoints, it's entitled to insist that you, if you're hired to communicate it for them, well, then you communicate the viewpoints they want and not the ones you want. So even in something as simple as this basic principle that you can't be punished for communicating viewpoints, once you get beyond the nearly certain rule that you can't be thrown in prison for communicating certain viewpoints, and even that has maybe a few exceptions. Once you get to the questions, what about loss of employment? What about loss of a benefit? What about loss of a contract? You get to things that are much more complicated. I'll tell you, I teach a class on First Amendment law. It meets for 3.5 hours each week. And about 10 weeks of the class we spend on free speech law. And even there, we don't cover all the free speech law. So we're talking 35 hours just to present basically the rules of free speech law. You know, it's hard to boil that down into 35 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today. To learn more, visit freedomofthought.fedsoc.org.